A young woman in emerald silk commands the roulette table at Monte Carlo, her beauty matched only by the desperation flickering behind her eyes. Across the room, a gentleman watches, not with desire, but with something more unsettling, moral concern. This charged encounter between Gwendolyn Harleth and Daniel Deronda sets in motion George Eliot's revolutionary final novel, a work that dared to center Jewish identity in Victorian England when anti-Semitism was as common as afternoon tea. Published in 1876, it became Freud's favorite novel and influenced early Zionist thinking. What makes this book extraordinary isn't just its progressive politics, it's how Eliot dissects the cages we build for ourselves, whether gilded by wealth or reinforced by society's expectations. When Gwendolyn's family faces financial ruin, her carefully constructed world collapses. She believes herself exceptional, destined for grandeur beyond ordinary domestic life. Yet her options are brutally limited: become a governess, glorified servitude, or marry for money. It's the 19th century version of choosing between soul-crushing corporate drudgery and a relationship you know will destroy you. What makes Gwendolyn fascinating is her contradictions. She's simultaneously warm and calculating, noble and selfish. What Eliot calls an iridescence, where opposing qualities shimmer together. She manipulates her uncle, dismisses her sister's struggles, yet beneath her poised exterior lurks genuine terror, existential dread confronting her own insignificance. Enter Henley Grandcourt, wealthy and adorably quiet. Gwendolyn sees him as salvation, a husband she can control because he seems passionless. But his former mistress, Lydia Glasher, reveals their four children, triggering a moral crisis. Gwendolyn flees to Europe, conscience-stricken, but returns when family desperation deepens. She accepts her proposal, convincing herself she can manage everything. This self-deception proves catastrophic. Grandcourt is a psychological sadist who enjoys bringing her to kneel down like a horse under training. When Lydia sends the family diamonds with a devastating curse, "You will have your punishment. I desire it with all my soul," the jewelry becomes glittering reminders of betrayal worn against her skin. While Gwendolyn suffocates in her marriage, Daniel Deronda drifts without purpose. Raised as an English gentleman by Sir Hugo Mallinger, he's always suspected he might be Sir Hugo's illegitimate son, a shameful secret that would explain everything. His compassionate nature leads him to rescue Myra Lapidoth, a young Jewish woman attempting suicide, an act that unravels his entire understanding of himself. Through Myra, Deronda encounters her brother Mordecai Cohen, a consumptive visionary who immediately recognizes something in Deronda that he doesn't see in himself. Despite Deronda's protestations that he isn't Jewish, Mordecai insists with prophetic certainty that his true heritage will reveal itself. Revolutionary for its time, Eliot portrays Judaism as intellectually and spiritually rich. Mordecai articulates a vision of Jewish national revival decades before Herzl formalized Zionism. The life of a people grows. It is knit together and yet expanded, in joy and sorrow, in thought and action. When the musician Klezmer is condescendingly told he has too much talent to be a mere musician, his response challenges Victorian prejudice. No man has too much talent to be a musician. Most men have too little. We help to rule the nations and make the age as much as any other public men. In Genoa, Deronda meets his mother, the Princess Helm Eberstein, a celebrated opera singer who gave him to Sir Hugo, deliberately severing him from his Jewish roots. Every woman is supposed to have the same set of motives, or else to be a monster, she tells him. I am not a monster, but I have not felt exactly what other women feel. This confrontation embodies the novel's central tension between personal freedom and inherited duty. The princess defends her pursuit of art over motherhood, a radical challenge to Victorian assumptions. Yet Deronda's response subverts expectations. While showing compassion for her struggles, he firmly embraces the identity she rejected. The effects prepared by generations are likely to triumph over a contrivance which was meant to hinder them. Asked if he remains angry at being something more than an Englishman, his response marks complete transformation. I shall call myself a Jew, and I hold that my first duty is to my own people. Deronda evolves from observer to participant, finding purpose in working toward establishing a political existence for the Jewish people. As Deronda discovers his Jewish identity, his relationship with Mira deepens into genuine love, a stark contrast to Gwendolyn's toxic marriage. Their courtship flourishes through mutual respect, intellectual companionship, and shared spiritual values, embodying equality rather than control. Complications arise when Mira's manipulative father Lapidoth returns, creating a new impalpable partition between them as she withdraws in humiliation. The crisis peaks when Lapidoth steals Deronda's cherished family ring. Mira returns with her hands clasped tight and her lips pale, overwhelmed by betrayal. Deronda's response becomes transformative. "Mira, let me think that he is my father as well as yours, that we can have no sorrow, no disgrace, no joy apart." His proposal demonstrates how love transcends familial shame and cultural barriers. Their marriage, celebrated according to Jewish rite, symbolizes Deronda's complete embrace of his heritage and represents a triumph over Victorian anti-Semitism. The wedding unites disparate worlds. The Cohen family, alongside the initially skeptical Merricks, who've overcome prejudice through love. This union embodies Eliot's vision of cultural integration without assimilation, where difference is respected rather than erased. While Deronda finds purpose through heritage, Gwendolyn undergoes a darker transformation. Her marriage becomes psychological warfare, Grandcourt's cruelties eroding her confidence. The boating accident where he drowns creates her defining crisis. Did she hesitate to save him from murderous impulse? The ambiguity haunts her. I did kill him in my thoughts. Deronda offers wisdom that shapes her moral education. Within ourselves, our evil will is momentous. Intention carries moral weight even without action. Yet her dependence on him reveals incomplete development. She sees him possessing an unknown standard, offering an inward safeguard against her worst impulses. The final test arrives when Deronda reveals his Jewish heritage and departure. For the first time, Gwendolyn isn't the narrative center. She feels the pressure of a vast, mysterious movement, dislodging her from supremacy in her own world. Yet in this loss, she finds moral strength. "I shall live. I mean to live," she tells her mother, words carrying true determination. On his wedding day, she writes promising to live as one of the best of women, marking her transformation from self-centered girl to woman facing life's challenges independently. In our age of personal branding, we've forgotten what Eliot knew. Our lives are inextricably woven together. Deronda rescuing Mira reshapes multiple destinies, his own, hers, Mordecai's, even Gwendolyn's. Gwendolyn's moral compromises reverberate through her entire family's future. The novel's final image, Mordecai passing peacefully with Mira and Deronda at his side, represents Eliot's humanistic vision. Despite vastly different backgrounds, these characters form a family bound by shared values and mutual respect. This is moral imagination, the ability to enter sympathetically into lives unlike our own. True morality isn't found in rigid rules or social conventions. It lies in recognizing our fundamental responsibility to one another, in using our sensibility as a faculty for ethical action. In our divided age of echo chambers, Eliot's vision feels urgently necessary. Understanding across difference isn't just possible, it's essential for human flourishing. The cages we inhabit can be opened, but first, we must recognize we're inside them.